highlight
27-hole golf course and Chautauqua's lakeside location makes it ideal for sailing, skiing, and fishing. Accommodations at Chautauqua include an exceptionally wide array of hotels, apartments, and rooms to fit any budget or style of living. Chautauqua's enlightening and entertaining season offers all the elements to create a vacation which will always be remembered. Our program today comes from the 1987 summer season. Our lecturer today is Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd is an author, entertainer, playwright, and humorist. Mr. Shepherd has enjoyed a distinguished career on public television and as an author. Gene Shepherd wrote and acted in the 1983 feature film, A Christmas Story, an adaptation of his novel, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. His one-man comedy show is a favorite at Princeton University, where he is the only performer to have appeared for 19 consecutive years. Originally from the Chicago area, the settings for Gene Shepherd's stories are often derived from his Midwestern industrial background. Here now is Gene Shepherd.
Hey, listen, for the last 3 years, ever since I was here at Chautauqua, I've been trying to explain to friends of mine in the business, you know, I'm in showbiz, trying to explain to friends of mine what Chautauqua is like. Have you ever tried to explain it to anyone? I mean, there's no way. It's kind of like a Disneyland of the borderline arts. I mean, last night I walked past and here were a lot of people waving flags on the stage. I said, only at Chautauqua. Well, anyway, I'm really glad to be here. And I'm not going to lecture. I've never lectured in my life. Lectures always remind me of somebody who gets up with slides and tells you about the beauties of Wales. That's without an H, W-A. I've euchred you already. It's early in the morning, isn't it? God, I'll tell you, humor at this hour of the morning is like listening to a Miles Davis record and having a shot of bourbon at 8 in the a.m. You can't be funny at 10:45. I can be soberly funny, ironically funny. In fact, looking out here at this audience of Chautauqua, I can only say, what are you doing here? Think of the things you could be doing. Just imagine. Instead, you're sitting here on a hard wooden bench, wondering what the hell this guy's talking about, which is what you do most of your life anyway. Did you notice during the Iran hearings? I love the TV coverage of it. And you saw a senator slowly dozing off to sleep. That his aide would whisper in his ear what had happened the last 15 minutes. And then he'd look concerned. Then later he was interviewed. He says, today it was a chilling story that I heard. Have you ever had the feeling that the world is composed of just nothing but soft kosher salami? That everybody pretends we're concerned, you know. Oh, so I'm really concerned over the Middle East. And then you wonder, where the hell is Lebanon anyway? I mean, but I mean, after all, the Syrians can't understand Cleveland either. So, you know, that's the kind of world we live in. You know, people, this morning I had this bunch of guys from the local press came over. One guy, there always somebody inevitably asks you, well, how did you get to be a humorist? Now, that's a very interesting put down. Because in America, humorists are not considered serious performers. I mean, can you imagine looking at Arthur Miller? How did you get to be a tragedian? How were you born that you see life through tragic eyes? Well, he's never asked to explain, because his work is serious. Whereas a humorist, well, you know, he just screws around, sits around and chews bubble gum, and laughs, and has a great time. But actually, there's a reason how you get to be a humorist. It starts at infanthood. That's a field you cannot enter. There's no way you can take a course. By the way, Americans believe in courses. We're the only people who buy books, and seriously buy books on sex. How-to books. I mean, it's one of those fields you either can or you can't. And studying it will get you no place. I mean, you immediately get ideas, you know, pictures of a guy in the back seat of the Pontiac with this girl named Mabel. And he's got his handbook out. She says, "What the hell are you doing?" He says, "Reading the instructions." Well, it's an American thing. I mean, we have books on how to diet, how to think clean thoughts, the how-to books. But there is no book called How to Be a Humorist. Because, you see, everybody secretly believes he is. There isn't anybody in this crowd who does not believe he has a sense of humor. And yet, nothing, friends, could be further from the truth. There are people in this crowd who have not laughed since 1937. The time their grandmother got her you-know-what caught in a ringer. These are the people who view life through slitted eyes, who have never realized the beauty of Ronald McDonald. I saw the actual Ronald McDonald the other day. He was standing in a parking lot outside of a McDonald's in Fort Myers, Florida, sweating like hell. Never thought of Ronald as sweating. He did. He was sweating. All the kids were sweating. The mothers out there were sweating. And I said, "God, we are all one." So as a kid, you know, here I was growing up in a town called Hammond, Indiana. How many of you ever heard of it? What the hell are you applauding for? That's like wildly applauding hell, you know. Yay! Listen, Hammond, Indiana makes Newark, New Jersey look like Palm Beach. It is a mean, tough town. We're the only, you know, athletic contests, we had all kinds of things, you know, you do as a kid. Which you, obviously, being in Chautauqua, you come from more elegant communities, where people have sailboats and do all that kind of stuff. But what we did was stand back in the garage and have spitting contests. Who could spit highest up the garage? Not easy, don't laugh. I remember Bolus right over the damn thing, you know. And he would get Mrs. Pissel hanging her wash. And then in the winter, we had other contests. The snow on the ground. Now you turn to her and explain that. She won't even understand it after you explain it. She would not know the thrill of being able to spell your entire name. Chester Wisniewski. That takes guts. A magnificent bladder. And control like you wouldn't believe. But that was the kind of thing by which local reputations were made. Like here about 2 years ago. Now, wait a minute. You think I'm kidding. 2 years ago, my hometown, Hammond, Indiana, made me the man of the year. That's a sobering thought. I mean, if you know Hammond, Indiana, and I was invited back out there, seen here where out in the distance you could see the dead steel mills laying out against the horizon, and the refineries were all around belching smoke and glunk into the air, and I stood on the steps of the city hall, and the mayor came out and he had this ribbon. You know, I don't know what you do with ribbons after you get them, you know, with a big medal. I've often thought of wearing them to the Red Lobster. Big blue, red, white. I mean, you know, a guy's got to show off his honors once in a while, you know. Man of the year, Hammond, Indiana. So I'm standing up there on the platform, and the mayor, I didn't know who it was. You know, I've been away from Hammond since I was 15 or something. So out comes the mayor, and he looked vaguely familiar. This is the mayor. Very official-looking guy, had the cutaway coat. He walks out there, and the steel mills are in the distance, and you could see the refineries belching smoke. It was the classic Midwest landscape. It's like looking out in the mountains if you live in Colorado. You look over towards Inland Steel, and then they point with pride, and over there is U.S. Steel. There's Youngstown Sheet and Tube. Oh, there's nothing like the sun coming up over Youngstown Sheet and Tube early in the morning when they're firing up the number 3 blast furnace. The smoke rises. This is the kind of aesthetics of pollution that is part of the Midwest. And I looked at the mayor. See, he came out. I'm standing there trying to look serious. Incidentally, George Ade, who was a great American humorist of the turn of the century, incidentally appeared right here at Chautauqua. And George Ade wrote, he was 50 times more prolific and famous than Neil Simon. He was a great playwright. He wrote Fables and Slang. And George Ade once said, if you want to get ahead, be serious if you can. Think about it. If you can. Be serious if you can. And I'm being serious. I'm standing up there with the mayor. And the mayor is looking out over the crowd. And he gives this long address about all the great men that Hammond had contributed to the lifeblood of this nation. Like, for example, Ray Primusky. He did. He actually said, we also are proud of the sons of Hammond, Indiana, Ray Primusky, who for 2 seasons played running guard with the Packers. I remember Ray Primusky. 6'7", 400 pounds, had a size 48 neck. He was in Hammond High 12 years. Well, why? Because he was an all-state guard. They're not going to let him graduate. He was a one-man offensive line. And he says, Ray Primusky, who played with the Green Bay Packers. And he listed all the other great people who had come from Hammond. And then he got down to the bottom and he named me. And I looked at him and it suddenly hit me. I knew this guy, the mayor. And he came back over and sat next to me. Somebody else was giving a speech. And I said, hey, I said, you were in my class at Hammond High. He said, yeah. I said, you're right next to me in the yearbook. He said, yeah. This is the mayor. I said, do you remember back at the school garage? You spelled your name including your middle name, in the snow. It was obvious to all of us you were going places. You thought I'd left the subject, didn't you? Oh, no, no, no. As a kid, see, I grew up in this atmosphere. And you either develop a sense of humor about the world you live in, or you plot on retiring to St. Petersburg all of your life. In fact, one day in Hammond, I'll never forget this. Now, this is the kind of sight that Woody Allen never saw in any of his early life. So that's why he writes about himself all the time, you see, as a comic. As a humorist, I write about the world because I find the world infinitely funny. Because here's a kid one day, I heard a lot of people yelling, it was a hot August day, just about this time of the year. The temperature in northern Indiana sometimes is up to 300-400 degrees. Humidity 900-600%. Hot, oh, mean. And all of a sudden you hear sirens from everywhere. You hear these, whoo, sirens. And my old man, who was a great siren fan, he loved it when sirens went off. Jump in the Oldsmobile and follow it. He loved sights of carnage. Well, it was the show business of that part of the town. I mean, that country. A good auto wreck was worth conversation for months. They even reviewed it in the Hammond Times. You know. And I remember the old man getting out. He says, my God, listen, what the hell's happening? We run out on the back porch. We see smoke on the horizon. We jump in the car. We drive over to the little Calumet River, which was about a mile and a half back of our house. Now, the big Calumet made the little Calumet. I mean, this river, well, I'll tell you what happened. The river was burning. From horizon to horizon, there was nothing but flames. Now, here I am, a kid, I'm looking at this. Our river is on fire. Imagine this. Thousands of fire engines arrived and squirted water in the river. Now, you're obviously thinking, oh, that was a great story. It's true. There's a big famous picture in the Hammond Times. It says, Little Calumet ablaze. And everybody was afraid that the big Calumet would catch fire. At which point, the entire northern half of the state is going up. So, it was that kind of life. My old man, for example. Each one of us in this crowd, at one time, was blessed with a father. Cursed, yes, at times. But we had one. Now, my old man would stand in a kitchen. We had this kitchen. We had a white kitchen table. How many of you had a white kitchen table that was enameled with little chips on the sides of it, say? Had this little drawer on the bottom of it, see? And in the drawer, you had little pieces of string and some old spools. And my mother always saved a jack of diamonds in there. Which suddenly showed up in our house. She says, you never know, you know. You may need a jack of diamonds one day. We had a jack of diamonds there. So the old man is sitting at the kitchen table. This is a typical vignette of my childhood. He's sitting there in his BVDs. Now, many of you know the name BVDs. How many of you know what BVD stands for? She does. A formidable woman. Anyway, he's standing there, you know, sitting there in his BVDs, drinking a can of Blatz. Well-named beer, by the way. Blatz beer was a big favorite Chicago beer of the period. And the old man would open a can, he'd hold it out at arm's length for about 10 minutes while the gas shot out of it. The gaseous beer in the history of the world. And it was green. Now, maybe you don't know what the term green beer refers to. You see, when they make beer, they generally age it for 3 months. That's Budweiser. But Blatz beer was taken directly from the vat into the can. was green beer. Mean. You could use it to titrate out the iodide solutions. The old man is sitting there with his can of Blatz, and he loved to drink this because you could take a can of Blatz, and he would chug-a-lug it and get it all down, one thing, and then that beer would start to work. And he had these magnificent organ-like... 3 or 4 octaves. And my poor mother, she's standing over the sink, you know, being a typical lady. She's in her Chinese red rump-sprung chenille bathrobe. She's got this petrified egg on the lapel, you know. It's her mother costume, and she's... Her hair is up in these little aluminum rheostats, you know. And she'd turn and look at him after that display of total slobism. The old man'd say, it cleanses you. Now, that's folk humor. So the next time you're afflicted with an uncontrollable moment of flatulism, just turn to your friends and say, well, it's cleansing, you see. Cleaning out the pipes there. Now, you quite didn't expect this at Chautauqua, did you? Well, we can all pretend it's cultural, right? So anyway, the old man would sit there, see, and I'm a kid, I'm studying under him, you see, understand? This is the early influences on me. And he's looking at the Chicago Tribune. That's a mean paper. I mean, it's the only paper in the world that has the guts to just simply say on the front page, the world's greatest newspaper. I mean, when in doubt, lie. That's the theory of the Midwest, how to get by, you know. So, world's greatest newspaper. And he's always looking at the sport page in my memory. And there's the headline, sport page. It's August. Sox drop 2 to Cleveland. That's almost impossible. To Cleveland. And the subhead would say, Luke Appling smashes 400-foot tape measure foul. Now, for those of you who aren't sports fans, tune out for a moment or two, but for the rest of us who are human, that would be the big story of the week, Luke Appling's 400-foot tape measure foul. And the heading that you'd read, the actual story would read, Luke Appling, the Sterling White Sox shortstop, came to bat in the third inning yesterday and threw the Cleveland pitching staff into disarray as he smashed the second pitch from port-hander Eldon Auker far out over the left field stands, a 400-foot smashed foul ball, before popping out. But that was enough to talk about. So the old man is sitting there reading about this. He was a White Sox fan. I was a White Sox fan. You never read pieces in these elegant Eastern newspapers about the White Sox. They always write about Boston. How much fun it is to go to Fenway. All that baloney. The old Brooklyn Dodgers. Hogwash. If all the people who wrote about the Brooklyn Dodgers went to their games, they would never have left Brooklyn. That's all baloney. That's called nostalgia, which America lives on. Pretty sad. The White Sox are out there doing it year after year, losing steadily. In fact, if you think this is a canard... One of my favorite words. If this is a canard, I'm going to give you some facts. The White Sox last pennant was won during Eisenhower's era. General Eisenhower was well away from the end of his tenure in the White House. when the White Sox won their only pennant. The one before that they had won when Woodrow Wilson was in office. And that World Series they threw. The Black Sox. And so the old man was a fan of the Titanic. It was forever sinking. I can remember him on a hot day getting up, sniffing the air. It's a brisk, hot, steamy morning in Hammond, because it could be cold and hot there at the same time. The wind would come in and it's cold, and the earth would be breathing effluvia up at you. And that was hot. He'd walk out to the porch, look over towards the Sinclair Standard Oil Refinery Company, which was off about a mile away, and you'd see this yellow smoke. And he'd look out there and he'd say, "Ah, they're making flit today." Now, for those of you who don't know what flit is, you don't know one of the more interesting periods of American history. Flit was an early insecticide. And you had a gun. You'd shoot flit in the room, see? They had a series of cartoons in magazines. "Quick, Henry, the flit." And you saw a dying mosquito falling, see? And they made it a mile from our home, and it would come. They had this big oven or something, and you'd see this yellow stuff going up into the air. And the old man would say, "God, we're lucky to live here. You know that? We get free flit." And you'd see millions of dead bugs coming down. Now, Woody Allen never saw that kind of thing. So I'm sitting there thinking in terms of flit is a good thing to the building it up there next door to you. And there I was a kid, you know. When you're a kid, you don't question your life, you just live it. I was about 6 or 7. And here I was going to the Warren G. Harding School. Well, now, I didn't know, none of us knew, that school was named after the worst president in history. Of course, there have been a few since, but that... we were going to the Warren... We didn't know who that was. It was just the Warren G. Harding School, you know, just one word. Other kids were going to the George Washington School. There was the Abraham Lincoln School. George Rogers Clark. And I was going to the Warren G. Harding School. We had a curtain. You notice this curtain back here, back on the stage in our auditorium? We had this gray curtain. And over the curtain was the school insignia. It was picked out in this gold thread. And the insignia said, "In hoc agricola conc. In est spittel lauk." Are very big on Latin in the Midwest. They love that stuff. That means, for God's sakes, don't spit on the farmer. What it means. Sputum et agricola est. And there I am, sitting there, and that thing is peering down at us every day in the auditorium session, and above it was this dome, like a teapot. Don't laugh. They were proud out there. Those are proud people. Had little gold, silver, dollar signs coming down out of it. And do you know that some poor little kid right now is going to the Richard M. Nixon School? He doesn't know who it is. Years from now, he's going to be in a bar, sitting there drinking. The guy next to him is going to say, "Jesus, no kidding, you went to the Richard M. Nixon School?" Yeah. So why did they call it that? Don't know. Who knows any of the imponderables in life? And there I am going to the Warren G. Harding School. And I had this teacher, Miss Shields. She's up in the front of the classroom. I always forever see the classrooms of my youth as this long, narrow room. Blackboards up in the front, on the side, sun coming in through the Venetian blinds over here to the left. And way up in the front there in this gray, hazy blue is Miss Shields in her purple dress. It's all she ever wore, this purple dress. And she had this blue Brillo pad on the top of her head. Well, when you're a kid, that's what it is. See? We couldn't figure out where she got that big Brillo pad, you know. And she's up there in the front. She's got these rimless glasses. And I remember her talking. To me, education is sounds and smells. Not knowledge, it smells. I remember Miss Shields going, and then these hands would go up in the front. Sitting back there. You know, I was alphabetically seated. You know, me and Schwartz and Zinsmeister, we're so far back, we never saw anything, we never heard anything, just these faint cluckings from the front. And up in the front, the kids' hands keep going up and down. Of course, it wasn't until years later that I realized those kids in the front were getting an education. And we in the back were getting wisdom, which the two hardly ever meet, you know. I mean, that whole crowd up in the front, that bunch of bastards up there, they went on to become professors and doctors. We went on to skulk through the weeds of life, trying to figure out how to make it from day to day, and the hands are going up. And every once in a while, a piece of pure information would get through. You know how strange this business of acoustics is, this mysterious art. I remember one day we're all sitting back there, me and Schwartz and Zinsmeister. This little crowd of friends in the alphabetical ghetto, we're in the back there. Have you noticed everybody who really makes it, his name starts in the front half of the alphabet? Johnny Carson, Steve Allen, Dick Cavett. There is no Chester Wisnowski show, I can guarantee you that. Because see, the kids in the first half of the alphabet think of the whole world as behind them, as their audience. Whereas us in the back of the room, we see mankind stretching in an endless line to the horizon. And whatever the hell they're giving out up there at the end, they're going to run out when I get up there. I have stood in lines in the army that stretched for miles, and they're handing all this stuff out. And by the time they get down to the R's and the Z's and the S's, they're handing out World War I uniforms. I mean, really. Got these puttees and leggings and stuff. God. So there's all kinds of traps in this life. There's the alphabetical trap. Are you aware that the AMA has recently released actuarial figures? Time did a big story on it. People in the last third of the alphabet live on the average 12 fewer years than the others. Listen to Charlie Abbott laughing down there. Son of a bitch, listen to him. Merle Winklebretson is not laughing. She thinks I made it up. Oh, yeah? But you're pursued, see? So I'm sitting back there as a kid, me and Schwartz. There was only one girl in the alphabetical ghetto, Helen Weathers. Had hair, looked like a football helmet. 4'9", 205 pounds. Could sweat at will, by the way. Terrific. And Well, everybody has a talent. Come on. So we're sitting in the back there, and Miss Shields is going, quark, 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 clucking away up there. And one day, clearly, we're sitting in the back, clearly, and it came through. She said, Bolivia, Bolivia exports tin. Immediately, a great intellectual discussion broke out in the last one. And I remember going home from school that day. I got home, and the old man is squatting there at the kitchen table with a can of Blatz, and he's with Uncle Carl. And Uncle Carl had these false teeth. And Uncle Carl's chief trick was taking his false teeth and pushing them out with his tongue and then making them click. Terrific act. And he'd click his teeth out there, you know. So the old man's sitting there with his can of Blatz. And by the way, he was an American. By the way, he was truly an American. One of the great American myths is that each generation is smarter than the one before it. How many of you believe this is a fact? This is known as the Detroit syndrome. That every model has to be better. After all, the 86 has to be better than the 84, right? In spite of that Reynolds wrap hood, that silly putty transmission, it's better. We believe this. And so the old man believed that I was smart. And like these little jerks over here, I was not about to discourage him. Now remember, I had been going to the Warren G. Harding School all these years and had not heard one fact. Didn't matter. I remember the old man sitting there at the kitchen table. I walk in. Uncle Carl is sitting over here. The old man says, hi, how you doing? Okay. You know how kids are. All right. I mean, every kid at a certain age is a total smartass. So the old man says to me, what'd you learn in school today? I turned to him. Uncle Carl is sitting there waiting. His teeth are clicking away there. I said, Bolivia exports tin. They staggered back. The old man turns to Uncle Carl. See, I told you these kids are smart. Jesus. Uncle Carl says, God, when we was kids, they didn't even have Bolivia. Bolivia exports tin. I have been, that, by the way, that's the one fact I have taken out of all my education. All the way on up through high school, college, the works. And I use it all the time. I'm at a cocktail party in New York. Here's Norman Mailer over here, and Gloria Steinem is Steineming over there in the corner. You know, she's got her big things on her. Betty Friedan is looking mad. Walking around, all these, you know, all the luminaries of our time. Gore Vidal is saying, oh my God, he's walking around. And I wait my time, see. I'm standing over there by the shrimp hors d'oeuvre counter, see. I'm waiting. Got my martini. And when I see a lull in the conversation, there's Norman Mailer discussing the world with Gore Vidal. I just walk over and say, sorry, but both of you are ignoring the tin economy of Bolivia. They're stunned. Then you leave quickly, see? Get the hell out when you're ahead. So, reputation has grown in New York. The Shepherd has a firm grasp on the international economic complexities. You can take one fact, friends. It could lead you to the damn White House. It can. If you know how to milk it. Keep wrenching it dry, bringing it out, cleaning it, bringing it out again. Because you remember, one thing you have to remember is the rest of the population has no facts. They are living in what I call, most of us spend our lives in what I call the feather storm. All vaguely confused. They believe the Cadillac is the best car in the world. That's the feather storm. They believe that the stuff written on the bottom of calendars is true. Penny saved is a penny earned. They read the Reader's Digest and quote it. Sobering thought there. And so there I am, a kid, see? Coming home every night from the Warren G. Harding School to the kitchen. And we had on the top of our refrigerator, by the way, we had this refrigerator, which was the pride of our house. We had this electric refrigerator. It was a hot point. Hot point. I don't know why they call a refrigerator hot point, but ours was hot a lot of times. It would heat up. We had this hot point refrigerator, and when it would go on, it would sit there, see? All of a sudden it would go tick. There'd be a tick deep down in the guts of it. And then it would go. And you could hear the lettuce bouncing around in there, see? My old man's beer clattering against the milk, you know. It would stop. It was alive. And on top of our refrigerator was our Sears Roebuck Silvertone radio. It was plastic like that. It was kind of round on one side. You remember those? Had the little plastic grill here. And it had what they called an airplane dial. Had a big gold dial. The needle would go around. And it was during a period of great optimism. Because this dial had marked on it Rome, France, England. It said you could get those places. Of course, our radio, all it got was WGN in Chicago, which was 12 miles away, see? So we turned it on, it had a hum. It came built in, this hum, see? The radio was, and through the hum, my mother standing over the sink every day. She had a Brillo pad in each hand. Like most true Midwestern mothers of the period, she felt that if she could get the right Brillo pad, she could Brillo away all the evil and the dirt in the world. She paralleled dirt with evil. She had her Brillo pads, her hair is up. And at night, just about 4 or 5 o'clock, when the wind would come in off Lake Michigan, which incidentally was so polluted in those days, the old man would stand on the beach and run on the water halfway to Milwaukee without sinking. Run back again. That was a big local trick. Water was viscous, thick. You could put it in your crankcase. And the old man is sitting there. My mother is looking out through the kitchen window. She had her windows open to catch what little breeze there was. And across, we had a driveway, gravel driveway, between these two houses. Next to us was Mrs. Bruner in her kitchen. And she's in her bathrobe. And she's looking out of her kitchen into our kitchen. My mother's looking at her. Looking out across that great gulf of the driveway. And on the radio is Bing Crosby singing through the hum. Sweet Leilani, heavenly flower, boo, 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 boo. Remember the old man saying, what the hell is a Leilani? What is a Leilani? My mother says, if you have to ask, you'll never know. It's the difference between men and women. My mother was a romantic. The old man was a Sox fan. Never, never come together. And she's looking out there at 6 o'clock. Bing Crosby goes off. And on came the only radio show I listened to. I wasn't a radio fan as a kid. But at 6 o'clock, this show came on. The radio would go, doom, doom, doom. There'd be a pause, a pregnant pause. And I'm sitting there at the kitchen table. And then this trio would sing, who's that little chatterbox? The one with curly auburn locks. Who do I see? It's little orphan Annie. La da da dee dee dee. Little orphan Annie. And then they would sing a little more. They'd say, la da 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 da. How does Sandy go? You can do better than that. Your Chautauquans, let's hear it. Arf! Once more. Arf! That's power. Getting 1,000 Chautauquans to all arf in unison. Arfing together. Which is the only way to arf, friends. And I tell you, God... Oh, that's another... I was slipping into my PTL pitch there. Oh, Lord. I'd heard a terrible Tammy Baker joke. I shouldn't tell you this. Well, the other day they hosed her down and got rid of all that mascara and they found Jimmy Hoffa. I'm sorry. I mean, I was going to make this a serious lecture morning. It's all gone to hell, Mom. And every day this would come on. Who's that little chatterbox? It was an inspirational show. And on would come this announcer, Pierre André. You know, everybody in this room now, we're all 20th century men, even these kids, all of us, we're all products of media in one way or another. And here would come on Pierre André. In the middle of that song, he'd say, fellas and gals, it's time for another adventure of Little Orphan Annie, brought to you by that rich, chocolatey, malted milk-like drink, Ovaltine. And today, boys and girls, after today's adventure, we're going to have a meeting of the Little Orphan Annie's secret circle. So get out your decoder pins and get ready to take down today's secret message from Annie herself, brought to you by Ovaltine, the rich, chocolatey drink. And now we rejoin Little Orphan Annie and Joe Corntassel as they fight the Bermuda Pirates. And they would come on fighting pirates. We didn't have pirates in Hammond. Just guys that stole hubcaps. Already at the age of 10, I was an accomplished gas siphoner. How many of you ever siphoned gas in anger? Gas you needed. I'd go out and suck gas for Flick's car late at night out of Mrs. Anderson's Pontiac. And in the dark of the night, I was so good at it, I could tell what brand it was. My favorite was Texaco. Had a nice after-dinner tang to it. Phillips 66 was kind of sweet, like Mogan David or something. You know, a wine for elderly people. And there I am, see, sitting there listening to this adventure. And I'm listening to it. And then on would come Pierre André again. It's all over. And he would say this. Boys and girls, get out your decoder pin. You members of the Little Orphan Annie's secret circle. Set your pins at B12. Here is a message from Annie herself. 6, 22, 19, 4, 12, 5. And I'm sitting there listening to this. Because already at the age of 9, I was a member of one of the most subtle outgroups. I was in a non-Ovaltine drinking neighborhood. I had no pin. And then Pierre Andre would finish. He'd say, "All right, fellas and girls, that's that message tonight from Annie herself to the members of the secret circle. And don't let anyone know what this message is. It's secret." And then they'd sing, "Who's that little chatterbox?" And they would disappear. Doom, doom, doom. And I'm sitting at the kitchen table. I had no pen. Out in the darkness, you could sense millions of rich kids decoding, getting the message. Have you ever had a feeling all of your life that the others are really invited to the party? And you're just there, screwing around? How many of you reach the age of 94 and you haven't decided what you're going to do yet in life? Life has decided it. I had no pin. So I began to nudge my mother. "I want some Ovaltine, Mom. I want Ovaltine." This was the beginning of my true education. It changed me forever. And we used to go to Mattingly's grocery store. And I'd say, "Ovaltine, Mom. Ovaltine." And finally, one day, she said, "All right, Mr. Mattingly, I'll have a can of Ovaltine." He said, "Are you sure?" I should have known at that. And she says, "Yes." And we took a can of Ovaltine home. And inside the can, as you pop the lid, is a silver inner seal. It's marked Ovaltine. You cut that out carefully, and you send it in to Little Orphan Annie, Checkerboard Square, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I sent it in. I could hardly wait. And I wrote a letter, "Dear Annie, I always drink Ovaltine." Good American. Already lying in my teeth. "I want to be a member of the Secret Circle. Here is my silver inner seal, signed Gene P. Shepherd, 2907 Cleveland Street, age 9. And I started to wait. And that night was one of the big moments of my life in education, because for years I'd been hearing Pierre Andre say that this wonderful chocolatey drink, just put milk in and you've got a malted milk that bubbles and sizzles and is thick and delicious. My mother put this glass of milk in front of me, opened the Ovaltine, took 2 tablespoons, and it sank to the bottom. There's a bunch of little brown BBs in the bottom of the glass. She says, "Well, stir it." And I stirred it, and it was just a bunch of brown BBs and went round and round. She says, "Drink it." I took a sip of it. It tastes a little bit like vaguely cocoa-flavored milk of magnesia. And my mother says, "You're going to drink all of it. And you're going to have it every night." And for 2 years, I drank Ovaltine, friends. I was paying for my sins. We all do in the end. And, you know, later on, you kind of get used to this. Now I drink Ovaltine with vodka, and it's a drink called Little Orphan Annie's Downfall. It's terrific. As a kid, you know, there I am. I've got my letter in the mail, see? So I started to wait. A couple of weeks later, I came home from school, and there was my pin. And the secret decoder card, and my membership card, and the pin, the whole works. And it was signed by Pierre Andre. And countersigned, there was a little paw mark there by Sandy. I still have that card. It's in my wallet. It's a little gold card. It says, "To be given all honors and rights accruing to a full member of the Little Orphan Annie Secret Circle in perpetuity." Once in a while, we old Secret Circle members get together at the Yale Club, exchange the password, which is like this. You go like that. You hook fingers. We go into the bar and drink a little Ovaltine and vodka. And the password is always ARF. And I'm in the only place in the house where a kid of 9 can decode. Because just before that, I had listened to my first message. Pierre André says, set your pins at C9. 14, 22, 8. And I'm writing it down. My kid brother is whining. He doesn't have a pin. My brother Randy was 2 years younger than I was. And he could make his nose run at will. That was his weapon. He was a whiner. His nose would run on your shoes. Wanted this pin. Now I'm sitting in the only room in the house where a boy of 9 can decode. In private. Set my pin to C9. My kid brother's already banging on the door. He's got to go, and I'm turning this thing. 722 BE. That's a word. BE. It's for Manny herself. What is she saying to me? 16T. 4-2. Be sure. 2. 5-D. R. 19. I. N. K. D. Sure to drink. O. V. A. Son of a bitch. A crummy commercial. Well, I left that room. When I left that room, I was 42. And that is how I became a humorist. Thank you. Thank you, gang. Let's hear it.
You have been listening to a lecture which occurred in the summer of 1987 at the Chautauqua Institution. The speaker was Gene Shepherd. Cassette copies of this lecture are available from the bookstore of the Chautauqua Institution. The price, including postage and handling, is $8.50. The address is the bookstore, Chautauqua Institution, Chautauqua, New York, 14722. Ask for the Gene Shepherd Lecture from the 1987 Chautauqua Lecture Series. Additional funds for support of this program can be sent to the Annual Fund Office of the Chautauqua Institution. This program was recorded and prepared by public radio station WQLN-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm Joe Wisniewski. Thank you for listening to another lecture from the 1987 season of the Chautauqua Institution. Thank you.